I will call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Friday, February 1st. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present today, Vice Chair Senator Dyson, Senator Faircloth, Senator Bishop. I believe Senator Machiki will be on the way shortly, and myself, Senator Giesel. Absent today will be Senator McGuire and Senator French. So, before we get started today, in your packet, I've given you an article to read in all your free time over the weekend about some change in the UK tax regime related to their brownfield developments, which are the equivalent of their legacy fields. So just some interesting reading that will be relevant as we move through the session here. Let the record reflect that Senator Machiki has joined us. And we'll get started. Today, we are honored to have with us Bill Barron. He is the director of the Division of Oil and Gas, and he's going to be walking us through petroleum leasing and unitization as we continue our discussion on the fundamentals of the oil patch. So, Director Barron, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, ma'am. For the record, my name is Bill Barron, and I am the director of the State Oil and Gas Division of Oil and Gas. And thank you for the opportunity to walk the committee through a piece of the business that is it's on the land side, but it's a very fundamental piece one of the cornerstones of the business, not necessarily engineering, but land and land management and resource management. So with that, I'm going to walk you through the three primary management stages of the life of an oil and gas exploration and development that we have in the state, and typically in most of the lower 48 as well. And it's the primary is the leasing, and from the leasing, which is actually the opportunity for the state to lease the rights for the oil and gas mineral rights of the state, and then get into the development phase, which is through unitization, the creation of units, and then subsequent to that, the creation and management of resources through participating areas. So let's start with leasing. Leasing is the first step in the whole process. This is where the state grants exclusive rights to explore and develop the oil and gas minerals of the state of Alaska to private parties. I'm not going to talk about timber. I'm not going to talk about mining. This is going to be strictly just oil and gas. We have an ongoing and fairly robust five-year program of lease sales. And every year we publish the following document. I think you guys have probably seen this. We have three area-wide lease sales. They are competitive bids. We have, over time, changed the terms and conditions of those lease sales, and I'll get into that a little bit. But it's also important to know that typically our tracts that we lease, we lease out on a track-by-track basis, and those are typically 3 miles by 3 miles in dimension. A subtle piece, and I think you'll see it on one of my maps, is last year we did make a change in the primary shale area that we quarter sectioned that 3x3, and I'll explain why when we get there. But it was, again, we believe that the quarter sectioning was actually in the benefit for the state. So the area-wide lease sales. We've got one in the spring and one in the fall. The spring sale is Cook Inlet and Alaska Peninsula. The last several Cook Inlet sales have been very robust and very positive. 2 years ago, especially with Apache coming in a substantial way, picking up a tremendous amount of acreage. And last year, several companies filling in some of the gaps in their acreage, and new players like Hillcorp coming in and actually picking up some acreage. In the fall, we have three primary areas, but they're all bundled together in one sale. We have the North Slope foothills, which is basically south of the primary Prudhoe Bay area. We have the North Slope, clearly the Kaparik, Prudhoe, that kind of area. And we have the state acreage in the Beaufort Sea.
Yes, Senator Dyson?
Don't let me get ahead of you here. I'm quite interested in Alaska Peninsula, what I always call the St. George's Basin, Can you say anything about that, the timing and where that's at?
In terms of, well, the lease sale associated with the Alaska Peninsula sale?
Yes, sir.
That is in conjunction with the Cook Inlet sale, and it's held every spring. And quite frankly, it has received almost no bids from the day, from the inception of the bids. I mean, there might have been a few in history, but very, very few interest, very little interest by the industry in the lease sales.
If I may continue.
Yes, please.
Is there any seismic work been done there?
Through the chair, if there has, it's been limited. I can look into that. I can have Mr.
That's
Decker
right.
Look into it.
So, if I may, one more. So, why, what makes you all think people will bid on it? I suspect we know that there's some interesting structures out there, but...
Through the chair, Senator, it's, now I may have the story wrong, but it's the story that I've heard, is that... when the local community actually asked for that acreage to be put into a general lease sale. So the state looked into it, went through our best interest finding process, and established the areas that would be available for sale. And then we started the lease sale after that. So this was kind of the story I've heard, and again, those that would probably have more history than I could clarify, but my understanding is the local communities actually asked for the lease sale to be initiated.
And finally, I'm sorry, one more.
Sure.
So I know the feds have been interested and anticipated that might happen sometime, you know, in the future. Do you know what they're thinking or what caused them to think so?
Through the chair, no, sir, I don't.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir. So, going on to the lease terms themselves, the table in front of you is really, we're just going to try to target, just to give you an example of how lease terms have changed over time. And these are the lease terms for the primary North Slope area. Back in the 1998-2000 range, a primary term of 7 years, a fairly low rental rate at $1 an acre, annual payments fairly low and elevating through time to where it was no more than $3 an acre and a minimum bid of $5 an acre. That's very, very low entry value of leasing. The next tranche of time, same 7-year term. And again, term is important, and we get into some of this leasing. That is the primary term. So during that primary term is when the state would expect the companies to do the exploration and seismic and drilling activities in order to establish what kind of hydrocarbon potential is in the area. So again, in the next tranche of 7 years, the only thing that really changed is the minimum bid went from $5 to $10. 2005, the North Slope went to a 10-year term on the primary lease, and then back to a $5 minimum bid per acre. Soon after that, it went to, depending upon the geographic area, either a 7-year or a 5-year, and back up to $10. So you're bouncing around a little bit. In 2011, we, as part of the outreach program that we had in the division with the industry, we went to many of the players, not only the local players, but also to those in Houston and some in Denver and Oklahoma City, and asked them, as part of our general rollout and trying to encourage people to get into the lease sales, we were kind of asking them, from a lease sale perspective, what is the biggest problem that you guys have? And what we heard was, especially for the North Slope, is term of the primary term is too short. 5 years, 7 years is just not long enough in the environment you're working in to do what you want to do. We had one company offer up that really what you need is if you had 7 years and then had the opportunity to extend for a couple of years, depending upon what kind of work programs were completed, that would really work for us. And we went, well, that's really good, but statutorily we can't do that. So what we came upon was the idea that let's give a 10-year lease, have a $10 per acre rental for the first 7 years, and then elevate that in years 8, 9, and 10 to $250 an acre. The idea being that the companies involved in oil and gas exploration do one thing very, very well, and that is make business decisions. And our perspective was is what we allowed them to do was make a business call. If they had done substantial work in that first 7 years, the commissioner's discretion is that he can waive the elevation of the rental rate. If they have not done sufficient work to in the exploration primary phase, then they have a choice. This is where the business call comes in. They have a choice. They can either relinquish the acreage and return it to the state so that I can put it back in the leasing program, or they can pay the $250 an acre and retain that exclusive right. So again, we're trying to work with the industry. Some of this is a genesis from their idea of how do you make it so that it's a business relationship and allow them to make business calls with their own budgetary constraints that they might have. So that's where we ended up. Yes, ma'am.
Director Barron, what happened to the folks, for example, in 2010 that had signed up for a 5 or a 7 year lease term when we went to 10? How did that evolve?
Once you say it's essentially a contract with the state.
Okay.
It's really no different than if you were to lease an apartment and your neighbor rented the next door neighbor apartment for 10 years and you only had a 5 year. You get your apartment for 5 years, they get it for 10.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Now that does lead to some issues, but it kind of is what it is. But this kind of speaks to some of that problem. What we recognized was that the shorter term leases really were insufficient, especially on the North Slope, and quite frankly in some areas on Western Cook Inlet due to the remoteness. But specifically in the North Slope, 5 year terms, I mean, if we really stop and think about this, for a company to acquire the land, line up the crews to run seismic, to analyze that seismic, to then decide where they're going to put in an ice pad and an ice road, and to do an exploration well in a five-year season, which may be only 3 months out of the year for drilling purposes, is extraordinarily difficult. It's doable, but on the far edge of realist. 7 years is a little bit better, and that's kind of why we landed with the seven-year hurdle rate for change of rental rates. 10 years seems to be pretty consistent with the discussions we've had with the industry, and just from a practicality standpoint, 10 years feels pretty good. To the point that you ask, Madam Chairman, one of the problems that we began to observe is the role of the short-term leases. People want to try and retain their acreage, right? They want to try and figure out a way to extend the life of their ownership. So what we were encountering is companies were, with short-term leases, were approaching the division, applying for units, which we'll get into in just a minute, right before the end of their primary term. And, for example, the new North Slope unit applications since 2010, there were 8. Interestingly, new North Slope unit applications that are within 5 years of lease expiry, 8. So what we were beginning to recognize is that the short-term leases were too short, it wasn't allowing people the opportunity to do their exploration work, and they were using the unitization process to try and extend their opportunities. Unitization is not about lease extension. Unitization without drilling is not in the best interest of the state and does not promote competition.
So, Director Barron, could I ask another question then? So what happened with Point Thompson?
Point Thompson was a unit.
It was a unit. Okay. All right. Great. Thank you.
Question, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Machicki.
So just to see if I remember this, on primary acreage for an extension, it looks like it goes from about $57,000 a year to $1.4 million per year on the years 8, 9, and 10. Is that correct, for a minimum?
Yes, sir.
So it's quite a premium if they choose to hang on to a property for years 8 through 10.
Through the chair, yes, sir, that's correct. What we were trying to do very clearly is say, you know, and it got a bit of tongue-in-cheek, but the point is made, we want you to drill a well. We want you to not just shoot seismic and analyze. We want a hole in the ground to prove natural resource, to prove oil and gas. You can't prove it with seismic. You can only prove it with a bit. So you have a choice, Company A or Company B. You can hold the acreage, but pay me, or just drill a well in the first 7 years, and that will be more than sufficient. And once that's explained, most of the companies that I've talked to go, you know, I kind of get that, right? You've given me an opportunity to work my budget process and internally to the company, and you've allowed me that window of opportunity that I get to make a business call. Now, I may only have the elevated rent for 1 year before they drill a well. After that, commissioner's discretion, the elevated rental rates can go away. So, again, we're trying to build this relationship that is business-driven.
Thank you. Excellent.
So, one of the questions, Senator Geisel, that you ask is how does this play with, you know, the leases? And I apologize to the committee. This morning, as I was flipping through my exhibits, I looked at this map and I went, one of the maps that you have, while it's not incorrect, it's incorrect for this presentation. The map that you had was last year's map. Now, it's kind of interesting now that you can compare the two maps, so we'll just use my faux pas as a little bit of help educating. The difference between those two maps is really just last year's lease sale on the North Slope. So what we've targeted is just North Slope activities. And what I'm trying to point out to you is the coming and going of leases in their primary term. And just really the thing that I wanted you to notice on this slide is the red boxes are leases that have less than 2 years remaining in their primary term. Some of those could be five-year leases, some could be seven, some could be 10. Really doesn't matter. They have less than 2 years left. The yellow boxes are those that have 5 years or less. And the greens have more than 5 years. The dark shaded areas are leases that are held by units. So if you do take time and look at the two exhibits, you're going to see a couple of things. You're going to see that there's a red box in the midsection low of the main green area. In and around that area, in the original exhibit, there looked to be almost like a key slot of open acreage in amongst the green. That was picked up in the last lease sale. So a company came in and filled in the gap. If you notice that immediately below that red box, and I'm just using that as a demarcation point for referencing, you can see that suddenly there's smaller green boxes. That's in the primary shale area, and that's where we quarter sectioned the leases. So that's why you see the small ones rather than just one big one. You can also see that there has been an interest in the play in the upper left-hand corner, so the northwest quadrant. Some acreage was picked up that hadn't been picked up in the year before, and some interest in the eastern section of Greater North Slope. So again, the companies are picking up different acreage. Some are trying to slide in and firm up their acreage. Some are picking up acreage in the new shale play. So it's this dynamic issue that we're trying to watch. But more importantly, I wanted you to see that there are areas, these are the areas that are hot right now, no pun intended. That's where some of the active drilling is going on. This is kind of the Brooks Range, Repsol, Savant, ASRC kind of area in between Kuparuk and Alpine. And that activity is being teed up by and large part of running out of time on their leases. And that's okay. But that kind of gives us a heads up on where some of the activity will be in the future.
Quick question, Senator Machicki.
Quick one for you. So a lease expires. Is it available for another party that may want to lease that property immediately, or is it included in the next sale?
Through the chair, it is included in the next sale. If it is relinquished within a designated time frame prior to the sale, it is immediately put in the sale notice. It's all competitive bid. If you've never seen it, there are parts of it that are kind of exciting. There's some parts that it's about as exciting as watching paint dry. But it is my leasing team is exceptional in their process. We handle millions of dollars on a closed seal bid that are opened in front of the public. And it is really an interesting thing to be in, and you read every bid. So I don't know the results until they hand me the envelope and I read every bid. So it's kind of one of those things that's kind of cool in some aspects, and if there's a lot of them, you get to hear my voice a lot, which is where the paint dry comment comes in.
Senator Bishop?
If a lessee the lease is terminated, are they allowed to rebid on the same acreage at the next sale?
Through the chair. It's an open bid on any acreage. Anybody can bid, so the answer is yes, sir.
Okay, so thank you. And one follow-up, ma'am, if
sure.
I may.
Go
ahead. I just wanted to step back for just a second. How much information do you receive from an exploration company or a major on a piece of real estate as far as well data, seismic data? What do you get to see? I know there's one well in particular I'm interested in that's the best kept secret in America. So do you know what's in that hole?
Through the chair, no, sir.
Okay.
Let me just as a follow-up response, hate to do yeses and noes. When we do get a lot of the seismic data, most of that data is deemed confidential by the companies, and we then have to honor that confidentiality. Same thing with well data, logs, etc. We do get a lot of that information. There is some that we don't get. Some of that is held at AOGCC, and they hold it in the absolute highest degree of confidence, even to the point that I don't get to see it. So there's a lot of that information, a lot of the information that companies volunteer to us and still requested to be confidential, and a lot of that information we get is during the process of unitization. They bring it in to demonstrate why the unit should be as big as it, or small as it is.
Thank you.
Senator Jason.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Can you loosely point out there where the Big Bear's leases are?
Great Bear, yes, sir.
Great Bear.
Would you prefer, I can do it this way, if that would work. Great Bear is, well, it'll work if my battery works. Great Bear is primarily right through here.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Thank you.
Before you go on, Director Barron, I wanted for the record to reflect that Senator French has been online listening to the meeting. He is out of town, but he is listening, if the record could reflect that, Ann. Thank you. Go ahead, Director Barron. I don't think any other questions, committee members? No. All right.
Thank you very much. So part of the next slide is tapping into some of the questions that we've already fielded. It's lease extensions. And how can a lease be extended? There's only a few ways. One is unitization, and we'll address a little bit of that more later. One is through a certified well, and that is a well that has been certified. It's kind of circular logic, but it's a well that has been certified by the Division of Oil and Gas that it can produce in paying quantities, whether it's producing or not. It is a well that has been drilled, tested, and the companies have given us enough information that we can say, yes, it can produce in paying quantities. Another way to extend the lease is through actual sustained production. And the final is through an active drilling of a well. So the reason why that last one is on there is important because, especially with some of these shorter term leases, if a company has mobilized and is in active drilling of a well at the time of their lease expiration, we don't pull the lease on them. Now, that's just bad business, right? We say, we get it, you're working it, you're drilling, you know, your lease will be held until the results of the well. So again, it's kind of this business relationship. And I mean, that's just good business. So let's now talk about unitization. The unitization is really just a mechanism to join contiguous leased tracts of land together to form a unit. We do that to protect the interests of all parties, including the state. We form units to ensure proper reservoir management and to enhance the recovery of the reserves. So what does all that mean, and why do we do it? Let's a little bit of industry history. If you did not have a unit and you were side by side with a competitive company in the same reservoir, without unitization, that would be deemed a competitive reservoir. And the more you can produce, the less your neighbor can produce. That is a way that the industry worked 100 years ago. And it is a really poor, inefficient way for ultimate recovery, because that does not encourage people to install enhanced oil recovery, water floods, polymer floods. It does not encourage any of that activity. What it encourages is rapid depletion, massive extraction without forethought. So unitization was a concept that was developed in probably West Texas and Oklahoma to say, no. There is a better way, and we can do this and protect all parties. So you unitize.
Excuse me, Director Barron, could you pause for just a second? Senator French, I understand you're online. Can you hear me? Well, I just wanted to check and see if he had any questions. So if you hear anything, Claire, about Senator French wanting to ask any questions, if you'd just let me know. Thanks. Good. Go ahead, Director. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Unitization is all about managing the resource, and that's why I gave you a little bit of the history. It's all about resource management. The purpose under the criteria is that we look at conserve the natural resource, promote economic or to prevent waste, promote the activities of all parties. There are certain things in statutes and reg that we have to look at. We have to look at the environmental cost and benefit of unitization. We've got to look at the geologic and engineering characteristics of the reservoir. We've got to establish the size of a unit based on that information. We look at prior exploration in that effort. We look at the economic cost and the benefit to the state of unitization. And whatever other relative facts and figures, including mitigation measures. Now, that's what we look at. The operator's responsibility in their application is they've got to demonstrate a trapping mechanism, and they've got to demonstrate that a reservoir has been defined. And quite frankly, the only sure way of defining a reservoir is with a bit, proving that the oil and gas exists. And that's kind of where the kind of old school kind of perspective is: you prove it with the bit. So you've got to prove the reservoir. So pictorially, all of those are really nice words, but now let's kind of just look at an exhibit and kind of give you an example. What you've got on the page in front of you on the screen is three companies. We're really clever in the DOG. We can only get up to C. So you've got companies A, B, and C. Each one of them holds a different tract. What we've established is company B has drilled a well, and through other geologic means, seismic, pressure testing, etc., they've come to us and said, look, we think we've got a trap. We can show it seismically and geologically. We've got a well test. We can prove that there's movable hydrocarbons. We think the reservoir is bounded by our make-believe little bubble. That is what we believe the reservoir boundaries to be, the delineated reservoir. Now, this should have all been done in the primary term. So this is still under lease in the primary terms. We would work with that company, and we would then engage companies A and company C to say, based on the map that we're looking at and our assessment and company B's assessment, part of your lease is also associated with this reservoir. And then we would engage in those companies to work through the process of establishing what that reservoir kind of looks like, and then build a box around it that we would then deem as the unit boundaries. This is a very simplistic model, and it will change over time. So I know you have a question, but...
Senator Bishop?
How would this model work for shale?
Through the chair. The best way I can answer that is it really doesn't.
Okay.
And here's why. A single well can hold a lease. So in a shale, in a conventional sandstone or carbonate reservoir, a single well has been deemed, that's why you have a 3x3 tract. A single well, in theory, could drain that whole tract, and so therefore hold the lease. So in this case, in the example that on the board, a one well unit is a potential. We don't like to do that because, again, it's to protect all rights of all parties, and if you've got one party, it's kind of protected by definition. Shale, on the other hand, shale is a whole different issue that we've got to get our heads around. A single well in a shale zone will never deplete an entire lease. That's exactly why, Senator, we quarter sectioned the leases in the primary shale zone. Because from a state protection standpoint, somebody who owned the shale acreage, and they can own up to 500,000 acres, ununitized acres, somebody could come in and put one well down in every tract and retain and prove that that well will flow, have it certified, and retain that tract to the exclusion of everyone else and never be able to fully develop the oil or gas relative to the size of that tract. So unitization for shale really doesn't work. In fact, you could make a very interesting have dialogue around that every well is its own unit in shale, because a shale well drilled even next door to it in a reasonable proximity won't see each other. There's no pressure response. They just don't even coexist. Let me, and my RE team is probably on the phone and they're going to start laughing at me now. Let me give you an example from a dimensionality of the complexities of shale. Everybody's seen a chapstick or kind of tube. Oil flows through the pore throats of the rock. If this diameter of this chapstick is equivalent to or represents the pore throat of shale, okay? That is the area that is available for oil to flow through it. A conventional oil play is 20 yards in diameter. So that is why, to your question, Senator, unitization in shale becomes very complicated. Just dimensionality, it is not near as conductive and prolific as conventional plays.
Just one quick
follow-up, Senator Bishop.
I'd like to talk to you offline about an idea on that unitization for shale.
Be happy to, Senator. Thank you.
Any other questions from committee members? I do know that Senator French is online and is now able to communicate with us. He's been turned on. The audio has been turned on. So let me just pause for a second. Senator French, did you have any questions so far that you'd like to ask Director Barron?
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm listening carefully. Director Barton is a great witness, but I don't.
All right, great. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator French. Actually, you heard this last year, so if there's any tough questions, I may just default to you. So now let's talk a little bit about using the same exhibit. Now this is, and again, this is a cartoon. I grant you that, but it's good for illustrative purposes. Now, this is year one of a unit. There are opportunities for units to expand and to contract. So, say 5 years from now, the geologic evidence and the new production information, the pressure history, et cetera, tells us, if you look up in the upper left-hand corner, Company B is part of the unit, but yet, even in this exhibit, doesn't seem to have any part of the reservoir. He's part of the unit because we give some latitude of uncertainty when we establish the unit. We recognize that nothing is really absolutely known at the time we establish it, so we give a little bit of flexibility as we form the unit, just to be sure. If in time that unit, through geologic and engineering principles, can be shown that Company B's little quarter tract is not part of the unit, is not, there is no reservoir on that land, that piece can be extracted and removed from the unit. Now, interestingly enough, if on the other hand another reservoir is found up in the upper left-hand corner that includes B, that land then is put into a different unit. So land can come in one unit and out of it and into another unit dependent upon where the reservoirs are. So again, over time it can still be dynamic. Land can come in and go out, units can expand, they can contract, all based on the information that we've got as it's petitioned by the companies. So that's the broad base of unitization. What it's not, let's talk about that for instance. Unitization is not for conducting seismic work. If you've got a primary lease, or just any lease at all, you can conduct seismic activities anywhere in the state, especially on state lands. All you have to do is get permission. You can conduct seismic operations on private inholdings, as long as you get the landowner's permission. You don't need a unit to shoot seismic. You don't need a unit to conduct activities lease by lease, kind of to your point about shale. And unitization really doesn't necessarily kind of work really well for single owners. Again, it's for protection of all parties, and it's a contract. So you're kind of already self-protected. It's kind of one of those weird kind of things. Units expire. Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry.
So on that point, what you're saying then is if that cartoon that you had drawn were all, say, the purple color, all those squares were purple.
Yes, ma'am.
This person, this lease owner, would not have to unitize. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. That's correct. Now, that doesn't mean that we may not issue a unit. Mm-hmm. It's that all things being equal, they wouldn't necessarily have to have a unit.
So there's no benefit to them. There's no benefit to have it in a unit or just as a lease. It doesn't matter.
No, it does actually, and that's where the conundrum begins. Is you're trying to show if a single well holds a lease? Okay, in the cartoon that we're looking at, where the well is, where the well symbol is, that well will hold that lease. The lease next door, if it's not under production, if it doesn't have a well and under production, arguably, you could lose the lease by time. Now, what we're trying to do here is recognize that that's why you would form a unit under that pretext, or write the agreement in such a way between the state and the party that says that we believe this is all part of a common area for unitization. So again, it's the land management and resource management. It's kind of one of those arcane things. We don't see it a lot. I mean, we may be seeing it more because there's a lot of new players that are venturing in that are not part of a consortium or don't have partners. So it's an issue that we're looking at a little bit more seriously, but it doesn't happen a lot, not right now. Let's see, where were we? The unit expires after 5 years unless you have sustained production, which is what we just talked about in terms of a lease kind of basis. A participating area, or PA, is formed. And I'm about to get to PAs, or the existence of a certified well capable of, and again, it has to be proven that it's capable of production.
Senator Machicki.
Have there been frequent lawsuits of folks accusing neighboring units of extracting resources from their reservoir?
Through the chair, not that I'm aware of in the state, primarily because of unitization. Historically, in the years past, outside, yes, there were some significant lawsuits over that.
So,
follow up.
I know there's been gas issues, but has there not been any oil lawsuits that you're aware of?
Through the chair, not that I'm aware of. There might have been, but not that I'm aware of.
So it works.
Unitization, Senator, is it does work. And unitization, the end result for the state of unitization is the robust development of enhanced oil recovery. The ability for companies not to have to worry about somebody drilling and pulling product away, that they can manage the reservoir at the highest degree of technology possible. And that is enhanced oil and longevity of the fields is created by the process of unitization.
Senator Bishop?
The driver to this unitization, I think you hit on it earlier, and I might not have heard you correctly, but I heard you use West Texas, Prindle, maybe, as what maybe drove this theory going forward to maximize the resource, as an example?
Through the chair, yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
As a follow-up to that quick answer, there are several places in oil provinces throughout the United States that did not have unitization. And the classic pictures that you see of West Texas at Spindletop, mm-hmm. where you've got all those derricks lined up, all of those were really in the same reservoir. All of them pulling as hard and as fast as they possibly could to get whatever they could through their well. Really an inefficient way of managing a reservoir.
Oh, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate you helping us, Bill. It might be a little bit useful to explain to us how, when a field is unitized, the oil and gas throughout the area is proportionate in some way, I don't know the right word, so that everybody profits equally from doing all the EOR, enhanced oil recovery and things.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I will get to that in PAs. Perfect. Let's see. We've kind of touched on that. Well, no, actually, one of the things that we've done here recently, and again, it's really at the point of unitization, is one of the times where the state has an opportunity to kind of flex some of its muscle in terms of encouraging work programs. And again, we do this in the spirit of a relationship and encouraging advanced techniques and new drilling. In some cases, we have issued a unit where there has not been a well drilled. A company or companies have come into the state, regardless of whether the lease is about to expire or not. Let's just take that piece of the equation off the table for a minute. They've come in and said, you know, we think we've got something. We've got some seismic. We want to protect the acreage. We want to form a unit, but we haven't drilled a well. What we have done in the past has said, you know, gotcha, we get that. But for us to do that, for us to give you a unit, we want a well within a certain time frame. And typically what we said is we want a bond for that well. So if you don't drill the well, you lose the bond. But more importantly, we really want the well. And if you don't get the well, the unit collapses. The unit expires. So it's that opportunity of they've come to us with a business proposal, and we've responded with a counter. So that's really our first opportunity to do that kind of thing. But once there is a unit, we also have the opportunity to turn around and say, and we've done it just very recently in one case where a unit was about to expire. The company had not satisfied the terms of the unit, but they were diligently trying to do so. A few things had gotten in their way. Some of it's their fault, some of it's not their fault, but in general they were aggressively moving that direction, but they missed the window of opportunity for that drilling season. What we have in front of us is an opportunity to do what we call default and cure. We can find them in default of the unit, but issue a cure, and that cure would be, in this case, extended the unit for 1 year or a period of time with the understanding of they got to get their well drilled. And if they don't drill the well, then the unit expires, the leases expire, and it comes back to us for lease sale again. So again, it's just a little bit of a give and take. It's But that's the opportunity for the state to really push in and say, no, we really want these wells drilled. And this is the, if you don't drill these wells, this is the impact. So that's, at unitization, we get to do that. Now, PAs, participating areas. It gets a little bit more complicated because we're now not just talking surface piece. We're now beginning to think about things three-dimensionally. We're talking now things in depth. A PA is for, it's a specific, a participating area is unique to a reservoir. And it is separate for, there's a separate PA for each reservoir within a unit. A PA is part of a unit, a subset of a unit. All PAs create what we call allocation factors. Senator Dyson, this is where your question comes in. Allocation factors are determined by the companies in some of our very intense negotiations. And some of them are based on the acres associated with that geologic horizon. How many acres are on your property? How many of them are on mine relative to the total? Pretty simple. Usually not done that way. Some are based on oil in place. Some are based on recoverable reserves. Some are based on a combination of all of those and other factors. It's all about making sure each company is going to do their very best to protect their company in terms of what their allocation factor is. They're trying to maximize their allocation factor. Once it's set, unless there are redetermination points indicated in the unit agreement, those track factors are set. And you pay your working interest on that, you pay your costs, your liabilities, and also your revenue stream is based on those track factors. There are some urban myths about Prudhoe Bay and some of the participating areas that they had arguments over the size of the width of the pencil that was going to be used to draw the maps because that made a difference. Now, urban legend, fact, I don't know, but it's a really good story. These are intense negotiations. These are how many feet of a sand or a formation can or ever will participate and contribute into the PA. Is it 20 feet, 10 feet? Where's the cutoff? And interestingly enough, with new technologies and new drilling techniques, even those are now being pushed. Some of the old PAs people are looking at going, we had a 20-foot cutoff at the edge of the field. You know, we think we can probably drill now with some of the new technologies. That 20-foot may actually allow us to expand the PA. So some of that is, I mean, again, it's the life of a PA. So again, to Senator Dyson's questions, these are kind of fun to watch because people are really trying to do, you see some really good engineering and some really good geoscience put into how track factors are established. Because it's, at the end of the day, it's the bread and butter.
Pause 1 second. Just wanted to check in with Senator French. Any questions, Senator French? Not hearing any? We'll move on.
Okay, participating areas. Let's see, simple enough. They have to be online. They have to be PAs. You have to be producing the formation for it to establish participating area. Let's kind of think about this for just a minute. As you drill your first well in an area, and you drill, say, for example, you drill to what we call basement. It's the absolute bottom of the target zones. Sort of like drilling into a hefty bag that's full of balloons. On your way down, you're going to hit a lot of those balloons. And each one of those balloons represents a reservoir. And typically, you produce from bottom up, and primarily because of it's easier from an operational aspect because of reservoir pressure and hydraulics and just wellbore construction. But you know all those balloons, you've already tapped all those balloons, so you know they're there, but you can't form a PA because you're not producing it. But you know it's there. And as you come up the hole later on, or subsequent drilling with new wells, and you hit that balloon again, and you then begin to produce it, you establish the PA. PAs, again, can be expanded and they can be contracted based upon what is contributing in pain quantities to the area.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Machicki.
The top bullet, capable of producing, would not be in a PA. Is that correct? It's just contributing to production of.
Capable of producing is the key. So there could be areas in a reservoir that don't have wells drilled in them, but that body of land is still being drained by the producing wells. So that area would be within the PA.
Okay. If the PA is being actively produced.
Yes, sir.
I see.
That's the caveat. The PA has to be established. So that exhibit is really looking horrible on the screen, and I apologize. This right now on the North Slope, there are 18 units and 38 PAs, just to give you an idea. The exhibit that we're going to have to work on this. The exhibit that we've got on the board and on your paper is what we're trying to show is two things. One is by field, by time, when PAs were established. So if you look at the very bottom one, and that is Pico Bay, in 1977, the IPA, the initial participating area, was established. In 1983, Lisburn was established. In 1993, West Beach, North Prudhoe Bay, in 1994, Nakiak. As you can see, over time, new PAs have come on. And the same thing, every one of these is a new field and a new PA. So this is an exhibit for the committee to show how, in any given field, PAs have been created in time. Okay? So now a little graphics artists, and I apologize to Madam Chairman. It's better for you to look around and see this happening on the slide. What we also tried to do is show demonstratingly that this is Prudhoe Bay, the original unit. And you've got all these primary, these four primary producing horizons. In 1997, Prudhoe Bay, the IPA was established. Oh, you've got a screen down there. Okay, I got you.
Yes.
The next button in 1983, Lisburn. So you can start seeing these things fly in. West Beach in 93 is the next one. And North Prudhoe in 93. Very small little unit. Let's go back. Very, very small. Very small PA. Discrete area that was found and brought online in 93, North Prudhoe Bay. Very small, very discreet. But that's a real interesting picture to show it's nestled in with, at the same structural level, as Prudhoe Bay IPA. And that's kind of why I want to highlight that a little bit, because it's kind of cute. In 94, Nagiak. In 98, Midnight Sun. Now 99, Polaris. 2000, Aurora. 2001, Borealis. In 2002, Orion. Then in 2008 is Raven. So you can see over time, all these, again, they penetrated these reservoirs. They knew they were there. Some of these might be, like Borealis, is technically challenged. Anything that's viscous, heavy, those kind of products. They know they're there, but they're working on the technologies to produce them. Until they're producible, the PA's not formed. But they know they're there. They're working it. So again, part of what I'm trying to show you is the dynamics of time, especially in North America's largest oil field, is these things have been worked over time continuously.
Go ahead, Senator Bishop. I have a question also.
Bill, Director Barron. So with the four slides, the four planes with four units, for the lack of a better term on my part, and you show the different units, you know, how they came online. My question is, so is that 2.5 to 3.5 billion barrels of recoverable oil that we talk about on the slope, did they lie in that, in those, on those planes?
Through the chair, this is, let me just background question a little bit. What you're looking at on this slide is the Prudhoe Bay unit.
Mm-hmm.
Top to bottom, it's the unit.
Right.
The four layers that you're looking at are the four primary geologic
formations.
Each one, and you see different isolations, that could be because they're faulted off in separate traps. The total reserves that a lot of times that you hear from Prudhoe Bay, mm-hmm. and specifically Prudhoe Bay, are associated within that unit in all those PAs.
Yeah.
The aggregation of all those.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
So, Director Barron, there's a coil drill rig up there that can kind of hit these little pockets here and there. I mean, it weaves around. I don't know all these technical terms. I'm a nurse practitioner. Anyway, are each of those little pockets that they drill into then a PA? How are they classified?
Madam Chairman, let's think about this for just a minute and how to, when, especially with coil drilling or high angle or horizontal drilling, what you're trying to do is increase the contact of a wellbore to the sand face. Typically what they're doing is they're trying to literally thread the needle through a thin zone to decrease pressure drop to allow more product to come through with less energy required. So they're not necessarily hitting different pockets. They're hitting the same pocket in a horizontal manner. Now, if they're drilling and they're drilling directionally and they hit all of these, they probably aren't producing them all in the same wellbore because they have to account for the fluid coming from each one of the PAs uniquely relative to Senator Dyson's questions, how do you account for each one of the barrels? It's got to be allocated to a PA. So unless they have mechanical techniques or downhole logging or downhole metering to identify at what depth, what portion of the fluid is coming from that zone, then they probably aren't producing more than one zone or PA at a time from that well bore. Now, you can have multiple well bores from a single well. I think Conoco has just announced that they're going to have a kind of an eight-legged monster out there. They can have eight wells from a single well bore. And that's just the beauty of fantastic drilling. But kind of to your point, as I tapped on it a little bit earlier, some of these PAs were originally established with 20 or 30-foot pay cutoffs. With the technology like coil tubing drilling, they can reach in and extract hydrocarbons now from much thinner zones at the edge of the field, which would now kind of ask the question, should the PA be expanded? Right? And that's what we work with the companies fairly on a routine basis of really what is contributing. You've now reached out a little bit further. What is the drainage radius of the well that you've now drilled? Should you or do you need to expand that PA to account for everyone else's rights? Because that extension may actually bring a new player in theory.
Okay.
Really neat stuff. I mean, just the technology associated with where they're going these days is phenomenal drilling. It's just phenomenal. So, my parting points or takeaway points, the state manages an effective lease sale program. The fall sale and the spring sales for North Slope, Foothills, Beaufort, Cook Inlet, Alaska Peninsula. We manage the unitization process within the Division of Oil and Gas, and we also manage the reservoirs through the participating level or the PA level contributions. And we do all of this to encourage continued exploration, continued and aggressive development, and more importantly, prudent, sustained production. And again, that's all part of the land and resource management that is conducted through the leasing, unitization, and establishment of the PAs. That's what I've got for the committee. Any questions?
Yes, Senator Bishop.
Just one last question. Great presentation. You definitely know your onions, in this case oil and geology, but do you know of any other state that employs their own exploratory drill rig, exploratory drill rig?
Through the chair. Do I know of, I mean, just kind of repeat the question.
Yeah. Do you know of a state in the United States that has their own exploratory drill rig that goes out and drills up on their acreage?
Couple of points. It wouldn't surprise me if there is. However, another thing to think about is Alaska is a bit of a unique state, and we all know that for many reasons. But in this case, we're unique because most states don't own the mineral rights. Most other states in the union, private citizens own the mineral rights. So in that regard, we would be one of the few states that would have the opportunity to go and do its own kind of exploration work, searching for oil and gas on our state lands for our mineral rights. It's kind of a unique case. But it wouldn't surprise me that at one point or time or another, some states did do that. It's not out of the realm of possibilities.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator French, are you online? Any questions?
Yes, I am, and thank you, Madam Chair. No, I don't have a question. I'll just comment that I think the Prudhoe Bay slide with the animations was new from last year. I want to compliment the director on that. I enjoyed watching it. It was worth the price of admission, so to speak, and thank you so much for your indulgence.
Thank you, Senator French.
All right. Well, if there's no further questions, the next meeting of this committee will be tomorrow, Saturday, 10:30 a.m. We'll be here in this room. We're going to wrap up the DEC overview and then have a presentation on two bills, Senate Bill 26, Land Disposals and Exchanges, Water Rights, and then Senate Bill 27, the Regulation of Dredge and Fill Activities. Those packets have already been delivered to your offices electronically. And they are posted on BASIS for public access. So at this time, I'll adjourn this committee. Let the record reflect the time is 4:32 p.m.